This is How Success Happens, where we talk to polar explorers, war correspondents, founders, ultramarathoners, authors, artists, and a range of other unique personalities to help you understand the capabilities behind how success happens.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
When I'm training for an ultramarathon, anywhere from 100 to 120 miles a week would be in my in my training cycle. Lots of miles.
You sold something like 250,000 books.
I'm the managing editor at entrepreneur.com and your host, Linda Lacina. Today, we'll talk to Alpha Demolash. Hi, Alpha.
Hi, Linda.
Hi. She is the founder of Rising Tide Capital, a nonprofit in New Jersey that provides education, training, and support for underserved entrepreneurs. She's also an Ethiopian native brought to the U.S. by her mother, also an entrepreneur. In fact, Alpha founded Rising Tide in part thanks to her mother's example, seeing firsthand the power that entrepreneurship can bring for families and communities. Alpha will talk about entering the U.S. at 13 and not knowing a word of English. She'll also talk about going to Harvard 5 years later, and she'll talk about how that background shaped her and helped her build Rising Tide, and what's missing from the conversation about how we can really help entrepreneurs. So hi, Alpha. How are you?
I'm great, Linda. Thanks for having me.
I'm very, very excited. Can you catch everybody up who has not had the pleasure and the privilege of understanding more about Rising Tide Capital? Tell us about it, its purpose, and its focus.
Sure. So Rising Tide Capital is a nonprofit I co-founded in 2004, and it exists to provide business management training, access to market opportunities, access to capital, and mentorship for entrepreneurs who are starting and growing businesses. Just to give you an example, an entrepreneur at Rising Tide Capital is usually a mom. So 70% of the people we work with are on average, 41 years old, single mom, two kids, and they're trying to start their businesses on nights and weekends, in part because they haven't been able to pull together the resources they need to stabilize their families from working a full-time job, sometimes two jobs. And what we've realized, and we realized this back in 2004, was that there were a lot of people, younger people too, that were struggling to make ends meet even when they were working a full-time job. And so we created this program to enable people to have the access to the know-how that they need, to have the access to the community and kind of the social capital they need to be able to build businesses that could last and ultimately provide not only employment to themselves, but also to their neighbors and their friends.
Sure, sure. And just to give people a sense, when we talk about entrepreneurship, sometimes people are thinking tech startups and they're thinking of things like that, Elon Musk and things like that. Tell us about the types of businesses that these people are founding.
These people that we're working with are founding creative businesses, videographers. 70% of them are in the service sector. So they're doing something that is low cost to start, usually relying on a talent or a skill that they have or even experience that they may have from kind of their jobs, and then translating that into a business. So we have food service business providers, clothing, fashion, health sector. I mean, you have a gamut of businesses that range across industries.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Great. And so let's learn a little bit more about you, Alpha. Can you tell me a little bit about your family background? Tell me about your mom. You come from Ethiopia. Why did she need to leave, and where did she go?
So my mom left Ethiopia when I was 2 years old. She actually had to leave me behind because at the time there was a dictatorship that was pretty much after younger people, university students. It was called the period of the Red Terror. And essentially my grandparents, who'd lost two older kids, insisted on my mother leaving. So even though she was deeply concerned about leaving me when I was so young, she ended up becoming a refugee. She spent 2 years in a refugee camp in Kenya, eventually made it to the U.S., and then she started working as a waitress, realized also pretty quickly that the money she was making from her waitressing job was never going to be enough. for her to be able to save enough and bring me here. So she created a little entrepreneurial business, and that's a big part of why we're here.
Yeah, absolutely. And so that those days for her, though, right? So she's working all day on her feet as a waitress, and then at night, you know, she's working on her own business, right? You know, so what are those days like for her as she's trying to work to bring you over to America?
Oh my goodness! I mean, the kind of waitressing jobs that she was able to get were those that were in hotels, and so she actually needed to be up and out of the house by 4 a.m. and yeah. She'd work usually until 2 or 3 p.m., which eventually by the time she got me out here to join her actually worked out because it meant she could be home most evenings when I would get home from school. But it also gave her the ability to be able to actually launch her business and work on it in the evenings once she gets home from her waitressing job.
Yeah, and I think that it's kind of lost in the conversation sometimes in entrepreneurship, but this is the reality. The side hustle is the reality for a long time for people, and sort of getting past that that point is really, really critical, you know. And so there's an interesting story also with your father, and I think it's a really a searing image that I have of you in this. Tell me a little bit about your father. Didn't want you to go to America. What happened? There?
My father was, unfortunately, I think he was a troubled man. And so, my mom ended up needing to divorce him when I was 3 months old. So pretty fairly early on, she had, made the decision that this was not a good relationship. And so once she'd left, around the age of 8 and a half or so, he kind of showed up unexpectedly in the scene. My grandparents were raising me. Her younger sister, who was actually 16 at the time, had taken me on as kind of her personal charge because it was such a time of deep chaos and trouble. And so he had shown up and essentially stalked me and her until he was able to kidnap me. Yeah. And that was terrifying because he, was just, he threatened to kill me every single day. It was really, really awful and a dark time in my life. A big part of the contribution of his story in my life, however, was to really to kind of push me to my limits, to my edge. And I ended up thinking that if no one was going to be able to find me and rescue me from the situation, that the best thing I could do was maybe, kill him. And so I'm arriving at this decision a year in, I'm 9 and a half years old. And I basically, as I was contemplating this, because he used to torture me at night by having me kneel and while he slept and not get any sleep. So I was sleep deprived on top of everything. And so I decided that I would, maybe that was my shot. That was my opportunity to do something to him and run away. And I get this incredible vision, and mind you, at the time, I'd never, seen any TV and certainly not pictures of the cosmos, but this vision of the cosmos and this information that is basically the best way I could describe it, just saying, I'm infinitely valuable. I am as valuable as the universe, and he, too, is that valuable, and that killing him would never set me free. Mm-hmm. And it was just astounding. And I, the next morning he woke up and he was being, the kind of terror that he was, and ended up, he wouldn't even be able to hit me because he would just break down crying every time he approached me. And so it made me think, okay, this is interesting. And then he took me out to the desert. He pretty much, I thought this was going to be the end because he'd been threatening to kill me for so long. And we drove out 18 hours or so away, and we were in this little house in the middle of nowhere. And he used to ask me this crazy question where he would, say, do you want to go back to those people, meaning my grandparents and the family that raised me? And if I said yes, would end up in a beating. If I said no, would end up in a beating because I lied. So he asked me that question again, and I was able to just very serenely tell him that, you know, the answer is always going to be yes. I will always want to go back. But to the extent that I can, you know, listen and be there for as long as possible, I'm happy to be there until he figures out what's going on with him. And I think he was startled by the answer. And then I was startled because he said, then go, and released me. I was expecting, you know, that he would run after me and kind of pull me back in. And instead, he let me go. And I got to a major road and hitchhiked with these truck drivers, these huge 18-wheelers that were going into the capital city, Addis Ababa. And I got into one of those. And it's, you know, crazy times, like reflecting on it now, being so removed from that time and that experience and knowing what I know about the plight of young girls and, you know, hitchhiking with truck drivers is like the unimaginable thing to do. But it worked out. I navigated the intricacies of those people, and somehow miraculously they were able to deliver me to my grandparents' home in the middle of this sprawling city. And so it changed my life in astronomical ways. I could never see, and still to this day, you know, have that image of who we each are and how absolutely unique, uniquely made we are. And just that immense kind of recognition of the value of life, its beauty, and it has enabled me to connect with people in really deep ways, and I've been very grateful for it, because I don't think I'd be doing the work I would be doing now if it wasn't for that transformative experience.
No, of course. And you're nine, you know. What is going through your mind where you've just sort of escaped daily threats on your life? You're in a situation that is completely changing and uncertain and unpredictable. When you're on the road with these strangers, what's going through your mind?
You know, a big part of it was just surviving the ride, because there were two men, and they were they themselves were not angels.
Sure.
But they were checking each other, because they were both family men, and they both recognized my vulnerability. And at the same time, I think they kind of had ideas about who each was, and so they wouldn't do anything in front of each other, which I'm grateful for. So I was able to kind of, I think the survival skills that I had with the year of navigating my father and his craziness enabled me to kind of handle that situation a lot more adeptly as a nine-year-old than I probably would have if it wasn't for the experience I was coming out of. Mm-hmm. It really, what was going through my mind was, oh my gosh, I think he's actually really done it and let me go. And will my family still be there? And mm-hmm. what will they think when they see me? What would have changed? Would my aunt still be there? You know, so there was just like all these questions. And, you know, when I did reunite with them, you know, my aunt had remarried, I mean, had married. She was a young lady. And had moved away. And so life had moved on. So it was a big deal, but I was mostly full of just immense gratitude and a deep belief that anything is possible.
Sure, sure. And so you have this shift, you go back to them, right? And then you have yet another shift waiting for you 4 years later when you go to the U.S. finally. You don't speak the language. It's an entirely new place and culture and everything. And so you get to America. Was it what you expected? Was it what you thought it was going to be?
No, not at all. It was funny because we, you know, used to have whatever we could get our hands on, magazines or, you know, passing by and seeing an advertisement about something that is talking about America. And you always assume oh, it's the land of milk and honey. It's like literally like they're cotton candy growing on the trees and everybody lives in mansions and everything is shiny and clean. And when I got here, my mom was living in Boston at the time. And So Logan International Airport, I traveled by myself. Mm-hmm. So navigating 16 hours, staying in Frankfurt overnight.
Wow.
And finding my way to a hotel, which looked like an insane palace to me. So all kinds of like meeting the Western world for the first time. But then pretty quickly thereafter, first, of course, my mom was living in a much, much smaller place than I had imagined she was living in, and working extraordinarily hard. You know, she still maintained her waitressing job and she would, still go to work and then come back and she would make these gowns after gowns for these people that were her customers and her clients. And so she was so hardworking and she would work until midnight sometimes. And and she was incredibly valued by her community. Everybody thought, immensely of her skills and her talent and just the quality of what she was able to do for them, especially for their special events. And so I got to see how community works in this new context. My mom obviously was over the moon that she was able to reunite with me. So, she was in many ways thinking of me as still that 2-year-old she left behind. And so she had to kind of in weeks be able to see that I was, much older person than who she left behind. But she showed me and taught me a lot. She'd remarried at that point as well, an amazing person who was very keen to show me what America was about. And there was tremendous opportunity juxtaposed to also immense challenges and hard work and, just gave me a briefing of the cultural and historical context that I'd arrived in. He was the first person to tell me about race and, tell me that I'm a Black woman. And I'm like, what? I've lived amongst Black people my entire life. We didn't have any racial constructs. And so it was interesting to learn about that history. And so it was really, quite an extraordinary journey. And I didn't speak the language. And so they put me straight into actually a Catholic school, which meant it was also an immersive experience. And so I didn't have any English as a second language. So it was really kind of flying deaf and mute a little bit. And
sure.
Like trying to understand what's going on and not being able to share and express myself. But I learned a lot as a result. I was, able to observe a lot and absorb a lot.
Sure, sure. And you may not have realized it then, but now looking back, I think, is there also an element where you realize, how hard it is to really make it in America, right? To hard scrabble from nothing. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yes, I think in many ways also, because in Ethiopia, if you are struggling economically, which vast numbers of people are, and if you're really in a dire situation, you could tell, maybe you don't have shoes. It's like there are obvious signals of what's going on. Here, what felt treacherous was that you could be absolutely in the depths of economic despair because you can't afford food or you can't, afford basic amenities to survive, and yet you still look, like everybody else. So there's an invisibility factor to being able to express real material need. And then there's also just culturally, there is shame. There is, this is the land of rugged individuals pulling themselves up by their bootstraps. And so if you somehow was not able to make it, I think there is a deep sense of personal responsibility and isolation as a result. And so I was very, very empathetic to kind of listening to people who looked okay on the outside, but a few questions in, then there is a lot of pain. And I also found a few more questions in, there's a lot of dreaming and a lot of ambition and creativity that is often completely overlooked.
Yeah. And I think that other side of the coin is completely lost most of the time. You go from not being able to speak the language to, you know, attending Harvard University, right? As we all do, right? You know, as we all do, you know. And so you're there, which is in a completely new environment, right? Yeah, it's a completely new group of people, a different type of expectations, needs, all these things, and all this, you're also trying to sort of drive your education, you know. And what sort of things started to spark your interest when it came to your studies that kind of come to mind?
Well, the immediate sense of, I mean, a huge gratitude first, because I was actually, you know, I'd applied to 9 colleges. I wasn't sure how financial aid actually worked.
And sure.
I knew my parents were working really hard, but I knew they couldn't afford college. And so Harvard actually gave me the most generous financial aid package of all the schools I applied to. So it was practically free. So I was kind of liberated. You know,
yeah.
I felt very much like, well, if that's the case, then, you know, now it's on me to really, really listen even more and work even harder. And my interest immediately turned to government, in part because I had experienced the immense disruptive force that is a failed state. I have, you know, I still have memories of sitting in, you know, a dirt floor prison with my grandmother, who's trying to protect the rest of her children from this dictator. And so when states fail, and when, you know, what we so take for granted here in this country, our democratic, the democratic process, when those things fail, there are some serious and deep consequences.
Mm-hmm.
And so I felt committed to understanding how do you build governments that work, governments that evolve and are responsive and meet the needs of their people and kind of the times that people are living in. And so that curiosity led me to be a government major. Being on a campus like Harvard, part of what you have exposure to is all of these world leaders, and really in any field. In my case, because I chose government, I spent a lot of time at places like the Harvard Kennedy School of Government, which would host all these amazing debates and practitioners and leaders from around the world. So I had a lot of access to learn, but also to connect. And I kind of felt like, oh, you know, I could do so many things. I could, my interests are the limit. And so that's part of what ended up getting me interested in understanding really when have we failed to build the kind of governance structures that would preserve our dignity and our rights as human beings. And so I spent a lot of time actually studying the Holocaust, and eventually ended up studying the Rwandan genocide, and really looking at post-genocidal societies and what it is that they use to come back from that brink of insanity and suffering and pain. And so in that study of recovery is where I discovered entrepreneurship and how immense a role it plays in actually keeping us stitched together as people.
I think a lot of people don't really think about that aspect of entrepreneurship, that it has that sort of important role. Why do you think that is?
I think in part because of a number of things. One is when we talk about entrepreneurship, to your earlier point, the popular kind of vision and narrative around entrepreneurship is making it big. And, you know, I think especially ever since the 90s with the tech sector booming, really the Elon Musks and the Mark Zuckerbergs and others have really kind of taken on this iconic role of what an entrepreneur what being a successful entrepreneur looks like. The other part is it's really the transactional part. Even when people kind of get it down a level towards more of successful entrepreneurs who build businesses and companies in different industries, it's still very much seen through the lens of financial success. And, you know, when you're talking about money and material success only, often that is, you know, appealing to your, you know, your intellect in ways where it's appealing to the more transactional part. And the transformational part really happens in the heart and in the kind of the soul of people. And a lot of people who get on the entrepreneurial journey or sustain a lot of the small, tiny businesses that, you know, are on the main streets, in the garages, in the kitchens, are born out of a lot of soul and heart and passion and creativity that is not really looking at just the financial measure of success as the primary kind of driver of why they do what they do. Mm-hmm. And so it's often just assumed, and in our popular narrative, everything is around, hey, you know, you're not a successful entrepreneur unless you're making money. And I agree that financial stability and money is absolutely important.
Sure.
For many of the entrepreneurs we work with, but it is by far the most important. It's not the most important thing at all. It's not what keeps them. We know a lot of financially successful entrepreneurs who fold, you know, the business or throw in the towel because that emotional satisfaction and the vision and the heart part is just not there. And so I think often our narratives about entrepreneurship in the public domain are pretty shallow and not really connected to what makes people want to do this stuff.
Yeah. I think that's true. And even from where I stand, I think a lot of the conversations sometimes they just edge around this massive sort of gap, right, where it's fun, of course, to talk about funding. It's fun to talk about venture and billions and millions and things like that. That's a lot of fun, right? But it's a lot less fun to talk about the block and tackle of the actual day, how it works, right? And do you think that that's why we don't maybe talk about things like training, about management, about budgets, about a business plan, like things like that, that gets lost in the conversation about sort of how a business actually sort of gets some real movement, you know, the real planning, that kind of stuff.
Absolutely. I mean, it's just not sexy.
Yeah.
It's not like, in many ways, I think it triggers a lot of vulnerability. You know, for people. And it also doesn't kind of jive with our quick gratification, the instant gratification. You know, it's like, go big or go home. And it's like, great. But the vast majority of businesses that have gone big have done so a decade in. Like,
yeah.
Nobody knew anything about Google for the first decade. And yet, like, none of our psyche or even our emotional intelligence could kind of cue into what it's like to work on something for 10 years with potentially no validation, if not actually like real discouragement, regardless of who you are, regardless of your educational level. And then when you think about people who have not been privileged enough to have really affirming experiences in higher education or even any access to it, people who have language barriers, people who are women. I mean, when you look at the stats around how many women receive venture capital funding, mm-hmm. Talk about sexy stuff. It's like, you know, it's been stuck below 4%. Forever.
Yeah, sure.
And everything that we've done, all the clamoring, all of the rage, all of the move, like, it hasn't moved the needle. And so there's a part, it's not to say that we give up those activities or talking about access to those resources and whose hands do they lie and how do we break down those barriers. But there's also, I think, a tremendous need for us to really shift and kind of embody our own aspirations. Because there is tremendous power and tremendous inspiration and beauty and really sinking in into what makes us human. And that is, you know, when we persevere over decades sometimes to make something seemingly impossible happen, when we are inventing things, and then when we're starting businesses that are roller coasters, ups and downs. Small businesses are really tough to build. And the vast majority of entrepreneurs that we work with, their aspirations often, they're entrepreneurial, and we can talk more about that later, about what it means to be an entrepreneur. But they are often going to end up in small businesses on main streets and employ local residents and really build human scale businesses where they kind of touch and know pretty much everybody they work with and who they partner with. It's pretty accessible. The digital world is opening up new opportunities, but I think big part of what is important when we talk about this, you know, not so sexy stuff around business management, skills, training, support, the infrastructure that we build to nourish entrepreneurs locally in their places, regardless of their socioeconomic background, is something that just that we're disconnected to and kind of need to find our way back into.
Sure, sure. And a lot of the terms and a lot of the sort of practices of business can act maybe as their own sort of separate wall around business, right? Income statement, balance sheet, what are these things? Accounting is its own language and in a way. Plus, you've got, you know, all of these other practices, you know, and so people feel if they were already cowed or overwhelmed, now they feel like, well, gosh, I don't immediately know what that is. I can't own that yet. I don't know what that is. And so they might feel even more hesitant, I suppose.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that was the case for my mother. For now, we've worked with over 2,000 entrepreneurs and helped build over 1,000 businesses that are active and operating. We have over 900 entrepreneurs who are working through that kind of slog, that journey of building the thing. And, you know, the reality is that kind of stuff is always intimidating because it doesn't feel natural. It feels highly technical. And at the same time, the beauty is when you actually break down what's behind these fancy terminologies and vocabulary that we've, you know, created, there is actually immense joy in the mastery and the competence that comes from that. And that's been part of the most exciting thing about our work, you know, our community business academy. It's fully scholarship. People attend for 12 weeks this business management bootcamp, and it really walks them through some of those terms. But instead of making those, you know, that language of business first and foremost, we make the experiential stuff and the why and the how part of building a business, you know, the most, the first thing that entrepreneurs are encountering. And they're encountering each other, they're encountering ideas, they're often curious problem solvers. And so when you make it experiential, all of a sudden, all other identities, you know, I'm a woman, or I'm formerly incarcerated, or I'm a Wall Street guy, all of those things fall aside, and people are connecting around their identity as these creative, problem solvers. And then when you introduce the language, it's really like picking up tools. And that's part of our experiential program design for really a lot, if not most of what we do, is around making sure the tools that we offer are being picked up just at the moment when the entrepreneurs are saying, oh, if only there was a way, and you're like, oh, like a balance sheet. Mm-hmm. And they're like, oh, okay, I get that, you know, or like, instead of being like, this is how cash flow works and having people go blank, it's helping them really make it very visceral and tactile for why that's a critical part of how to monitor the health of their business and whether their efforts are going to work out if they haven't started yet, or you know, could be done better if they have existing businesses.
Sure, sure. And what trait do you think has helped you zero in on that, because I think that's really, really special. I, you know, talk to entrepreneurs all day. I talk to organizations that help entrepreneurs all day. And very few people are really asking people to focus in, asking people, what's your why, what's your how, right? To have all of the other nonsense fade away, all the other noise, so that they can just figure, who am I as a creator? Like, what do you think helps you get right into that core? What trait sort of helps you see that that's important?
I think in large part, and this goes back to kind of my own life story, and part of the reason why it was such an immense gift to me is, you know, when you have your why, when you have a sense of your purpose, it is the most resilient inducing thing you could possibly, you know, find. And so knowing that the journey of building a business, any business, is full of difficulty, in large part because business is all about relationship and relationship management, which means you have to deal with other humans and their failures and their ambitions and their all of that. And we are not all that great at managing our human relationships well. And so it means there's a lot of emotional stress. And when you add financial risk to it, and you know, it just ups the level of anxiety and stress, that makes, you know, that makes it very difficult to sustain a business and to sustain a good quality of life while you're, you know, building something. And so it's very, very, you know, I think kind of even remembering my own life's journey, having the example of my mother, recognizing now that we've been doing this for 14 years that so many of the businesses that closed were not closing because they couldn't find enough customers or access to capital, that often the emotional capacity of the entrepreneurs to weather the journey just breaks down. Mm-hmm. And those entrepreneurs who are super clear about their why are just breathing a lot better. And then their ability to innovate around the how, and the ability to be agile, to form partnerships when they need to bless and release certain situations that are not serving them anymore, to entirely reimagine themselves around their purpose, becomes a lot easier when the how and the why is clear. And so that's why it's a very strategic orientation for us to say, look, you know, we're working with a lot of entrepreneurs who are incredibly under-resourced when it comes to, you know, their financial starting point. And so it's very important that we build up their internal core capacity that is agnostic of their economic beginning.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And still, so you're someone who has, you know, averted a murderer, right? Navigated Harvard, hitchhiked through Africa at age 9, whatever, created a nonprofit, whatever. You could have done anything. You didn't have to create a nonprofit, right? Why is this the right path for you? And frankly, if I'm in any situation, I don't care what it is, I'm going to call you Alpha, right? Okay. She's the fixer, apparently, like whatever it is, right? You know, she's the hitchhiker. She's the truck driver whisperer, right? So why was this the right fit? You could have been helping entrepreneurs in another way, in some fancy building somewhere where you never actually even talk to them. You know, why is this hands-on approach so important to you, and why is it such a great fit?
Well, first of all, thank you for that hilarious recap of my life.
I work for you, Alpha.
Amazing. So what, you know, I actually, when I graduated from college and started, you know, I'd always been geared in this way. And so my parents kind of knew, but I think they were assuming that, you know, like 50% of Harvard graduates go and work on Wall Street and et cetera. So they're like, I'm sure somehow she'll just end up there and we don't have to worry about her. I ended up 6 months into trying to start the nonprofit and realizing, like, you know, I had so little financial capital. I had, based on pressure from my mother, taken a job at a Wall Street firm that shall not be named. and I actually, after 3 days in the building, I just couldn't go on. Not because the people weren't wonderful, not because of anything. It just felt like I had sentenced myself to.
Sure.
And I know I have a lot of dear friends who work on Wall Street, and I appreciate them, and many of them support my organization. And so.
Sure, of course.
And they all know this story. Many of them know the story. It's just I felt very much compelled, especially having experienced what I experienced. I knew there was so much beauty in people, and it's a grappling, you know, we all have to grapple with the dark side as well as the light, and it's a choice every day and every moment. But to the extent that I could align myself with people who felt perhaps trapped or who didn't necessarily see that there might be another way, to the extent that I might have that one conversation or stand alongside of them and help them see a different way and a different perspective, it felt like a gravitational pull that I could not resist. And our entrepreneurs, when I get to meet them, and we work in 5 cities in northern New Jersey, we just started expanding with partners nationally who are adapting our model. And I tell you, every time I walk into rooms full of our entrepreneurs, their energy, their vulnerability, they're such sophisticated risk managers. They're often mistaken as just risk takers, but they're not. They're managing their risk in the most sophisticated ways, with so little to work with, but then also so much wisdom to work with. And so I get to see this amazing, and to get the opportunity and the honor to be invited in their journeys and in their lives. And I'm bawled away, and there is no way that I could do anything else that would have me, you know, acquire lots of, numbers. Not even like, you know, it's not like I'm Uncle Scrooge swimming in my, pool of cold, icy cold coins.
Sure, sure, sure.
It's like there is nothing that could match the fulfillment that comes from having, you know, other people activate around their passions, and to the extent that you could, you know, in any way help them push the boulder a little bit further or find a new way. It's like I'm a junkie. I love it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think that's really interesting. I'd read somewhere that you had said that Rising Tide Capital was named in part because Rising Tide, of course, lifts all boats, but you still need a boat, right? And that you guys are the boat builders, right? And I think that's really, really interesting, right? Because anybody could sort of create a nonprofit, and those people are still to be, you know, honored. And gosh, people that create nonprofits of any sort are doing God's work, right? But giving money is one thing, and sitting down and training people, sitting down with what's a balance sheet, you know, this sort of management, sort of block and tackle sort of stuff. I mean, to use the block and tackle term again, is totally a different sort of approach. And I think, does that kind of get into, you were talking about this high, you know, getting into that relationship thing, you know, like you're trying to help them understand relationships because you understand relationships. Is there a connection there?
Certainly. And in many ways also, you know, when that starts to happen in numbers and you see it, you know, we're privileged and using, you know, some of the same tech platforms that we're, you know, the Facebooks and the whatnot, to see our entrepreneurs in, you know, 700, 800, you know, that are connected as friends, and they're working with one another and these networks, and they're collaborating. And when you know, the woman who's opened up a Montessori school has the guy who opened up a pest control company rushing over to bring his sponsorship packet for her school's event, and the property maintenance guy is running over to help repair a facility, and you just see this network of relationships and how far they're willing to go for one another, and how they are redefining success in really meaningful ways. I feel like, wow, that's the rush. And most importantly, I feel like this is the work, not just, you know, something that I should be enjoying by myself or my team should be enjoying by themselves. This is something to be shared, because there are entrepreneurs in so many communities across this country. There are entrepreneurs that are waiting, that are tinkering in their garages, in their kitchens. They're isolated. They don't have cheerleaders. They may even be grappling with family members and others who are saying, hey, who do you think you are? You think you can create this thing or that thing? And because so many of them are also women, I mean, my gosh, like, we called it Rising Tide Capital, agnostic of gender. And that's been part of my philosophy as well, is, you know, we don't help women by solely focusing. There are some things that we have to focus solely on women, you know, obviously, sure, overcoming abuse, domestic violence, and so on, and all kinds of issues, policy being one. But on a cultural basis, having 50% of the population somehow as a front for, like, this thing that we have to battle doesn't serve women. We need the men on our side. We need them to buy into feminine leadership, and we need them to say, yeah, you want to be an entrepreneur? I'm with you, you know?
Sure.
So we called it Rising Tide Capital, and we never called it, you know, Women's Rising Tide Capital. But 70% of the people who come to us are women.
Yeah.
And so recognize, and this has stayed consistent over 14 years.
Yeah.
And so knowing the demographic shifts in our country, knowing that when you look at even, you know, kind of wealth inheritance, the largest wealth transfer that is coming up, you know, like, I think it's like $58 trillion or something like that, going to women and millennials.
Yeah.
And their values, what they want to invest in, how they want to change the world, the ways in which they're on fire for causes is very different than prior generations. The ways even nonprofits and nonprofit fundraising, all of that is shifting and changing. It's a new day. And I feel like, you know, I'm constantly, as you know, putting up a giant invitation card for Rising Tide Capital. Come learn and do this in your community, and do this, you know, for your fellow entrepreneurs, or invest in them, support them, go be a cheerleader. Don't be a naysayer. Don't waste your breath. Don't be that incredible universe that you are, and invest that energy into being a blah, blah, critique, you know. It's like, critique and judgment has its place, but it's not here.
Yeah.
We need to celebrate the human spirit, and we need to learn from our failures, the failures of these, you know, small businesses, these entrepreneurs. There are failures to learn from and to pass on to the generation after. And so I feel incredibly privileged to do the work, and I also feel like there will be so many people who will be doing this work in the future. And you and I will get together over tea someday, and we'll say, my gosh, remember when we were having that conversation, and now everybody wants to do the business management training, or the kind of providing education, social capital, and using all of the tools in our toolbox to reimagine our communities and our human relationships in a way that, as you know, I'm sure you're following, will be so much more important in a vastly tech-enabled world that we'll be living in.
No, of course, of course, of course. Just to ask you, and I ask this of lots of folks, but you brought it up, so I'll ask it of you too. What does it mean to be an entrepreneur in your mind?
What it means to be an entrepreneur is that somebody who is a creative problem solver, that has usually a vision larger than themselves. And somebody who's courageous, it takes a lot of boldness to come up with something or even see something that someone is doing that seems incredibly difficult and do it and learn, constant learners.
Yeah. I have time for one last question for you, unfortunately, Alpha. I don't want to steal your entire evening here. But if you had a message of support for entrepreneurs who, you know, they just don't have the fortune of living in the areas that your Rising Tide covers or that the people that are partnering with you guys for this models are covering, what advice or words of support do you have for those folks who are toiling, doing stuff at night, doing what your mom did, you know, waking up at 4 a.m. and then, you know, spending their time when their kids are asleep, you know, working on their business. What helps them power through? How can they kind of find some comfort?
I would say that first, it's really important to tap into and understand their own personal kind of stories and journey and find their personal courage there because it is going to take a lot of courage to get through. I want entrepreneurs across this country, across the world, but particularly across this country because we've put up this notion that in a couple of years, you should be up and running and making tons of money and hiring others. And what's wrong with you if you're not doing that? Mm-hmm. That's a myth. Very, very, very tiny percentage of the population gets to do that. And so take your time, build something that you're going to be proud of, regardless of where it goes. And most importantly, you know, listen deeply to yourself, be kind to yourself, have a lot of self-compassion. Do this with joy. There is no one, you know, keeping a clock, really, because, you know, I think entrepreneurs and people often forget just how infinitely valuable they are. They are, there's no one like anybody on the planet. We're all unique. And so form relationships, be vulnerable, don't be afraid. And when it comes to the rejection, because there's a lot of rejection, there's a lot of, you know, naysayers or customers don't want what you build or investors may laugh in your face. And don't let those things stop you from continuing to dream and reimagine what's possible in your business, in your life, in your relationships. And you never know. You may be standing next to somebody in an elevator, and they may end up being that person who ends up connecting you to your largest investor or funder, or if you're doing, running a nonprofit, or connecting you to a customer. And so be bold, share your story, be an encourager, know that you have a huge role to play in transitioning our communities and our world. We are, living in an economy that is going to change so dramatically in the next 10 to 20 years. And being an entrepreneur means being that wayfinder, being that guide, really enabling your visioning capacity. And so I have really wonderful and high expectations of entrepreneurs who are out there slogging it through. But I know they relate to having a sense of purpose and just trust and believe that when all of your powerful intentions are directed towards what's really authentic to you and true to you, the right relationships will show up. And you will overcome, and you will have a phenomenal story when you're done.
That's amazing. Well, unfortunately, that's all the time we have, Alpha. But it was just an honor to have you here. It was a real privilege.
Thank you so much, Linda. And I look forward to connecting with you again at another time. Thank you for the opportunity to share my story.
Oh, it's wonderful. And before we go, some short announcements for our listeners. How Success Happens comes out weekly. To make sure you don't miss a single episode, subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and SoundCloud, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. And don't be afraid to leave us a review. It helps us improve and reach more listeners just like you. And for more stories like this one on the mindset that you need to grow a business, go to entrepreneur.com. And to let me know what you think about the show, Find me on Twitter, at LINDALACINA. That's the at symbol, LINDALACINA. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.